Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, good evening, good morning from wherever you are listening from. Welcome to Revolution Radio, a special segment. This is Dr. Kate. I'd like to welcome all of our military personnel who may be listening, taking a break, all of our former military personnel, all of those folks who are birthers out there, and all of those who are also concerned about 9/11. We've got a lot of work to do to take our country back. There's much going on in our country right now, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. Remember that John F. Kennedy said in his inaugural speech that those who make peaceful revolution impossible will make violent revolution inevitable. We are right now using, to the best of our ability, the constitutional tools and vehicles that our founders provided to us to help bring our country back. The Continental Congress 2009, the Patriot Movement, the Tea Party Movement, all of those who are engaged right now are concerned about our Constitution. And we simply must revolve back to constitutional governance. It will take a while. It doesn't end with this year's election. In fact, it just begins. Well, my friends, again, welcome. The reason I'm doing this show is I've been trying to do a podcast of Delegate Jeff Williams from Washington State's new show called Paradigm Shift. I've been working with MP4 files and MP3 files and trying to schedule shows, and I finally figured it out how to do this. This was my show on Paradigm Shift that was scheduled a few weeks ago. I have the opportunity right now to get into this show. I'm going to play it fully as a podcast. It's called Paradigm Shift Episode 1. And what it has to do really with is the Second Amendment and refusing to stay caught in a left-right, right paradigm, a Republican-Democrat paradigm. All the past paradigms are not working. We need to simply follow the Constitution. So this episode is a terrific episode with the Gun Owners of America. Jeff Williams, who will start it all out, has made this podcast, and also an interview with Michael Badnarik is here as well. So I'm going to launch right into this. It's about a 57-minute show, and I'll be back with a little commentary after that. Your calls will be welcome later. You're welcome to sit in the chat or just listen to this great show. So without any further ado, I'm heading in there. If it needs to be louder or so forth, please don't hesitate to give a call or send me a note in the chat room. So here we go, Paradigm Shift, Episode 1.
Vice President Johnson, Mr. Speaker, Mr. Chief Justice, President Eisenhower, Vice President Nixon, President Truman, Reverend clergy, fellow citizens. We observe today.
I can't believe it. I did it again. I have the wrong podcast yet again. So, my friends, I'm just going to have to get out of this show again. And I will keep trying to get this correct podcast up for your listening pleasure. I'm going to end with some music. I can't believe it here. So, let me go ahead and play President Kennedy's inaugural address and close with some music. Sorry, I can drill a well for you, but apparently I can't seem to operate this computer properly. I will talk with you soon. Thank you.
Vice President Johnson, Mr. Speaker, Mr. Chief Justice, President Eisenhower, Vice President Nixon, President Truman, Reverend clergy, fellow citizens. We observe today not a victory of party, but a celebration of freedom, symbolizing an end as well as a beginning, signifying renewal as well as change. For I have sworn before you and Almighty God the same solemn oath our forebears prescribed nearly a century and three quarters ago. The world is very different now, for man holds in his mortal hands the power to abolish all forms of human poverty and all forms of human life. And yet the same revolutionary belief for which our forebears fought are still at issue around the globe. The belief that the rights of man come not from the generosity of the state, but from the hand of God. We dare not forget today that we are the heirs of that first revolution. Let the word go forth from this time and place to friend and foe alike, that the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans born in this century, tempered by war, disciplined by a hard and bitter peace, proud of our ancient heritage, and unwilling to witness or permit the slow undoing of those human rights to which this nation has always been committed and to which we are committed today at home and around the world. Let every nation know, whether it wishes us well or ill, that we shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe, to assure the survival and the success of liberty. This much we pledge and more. To those old allies whose cultural and spiritual origins we share, we pledge the loyalty of faithful friends. United, there is little we cannot do in a host of cooperative ventures. Divided, there is little we can do, for we dare not meet a powerful challenge at odds and split asunder. To those new states whom we welcome to the ranks of the free, we pledge our word that one form of colonial control shall not have passed away merely to be replaced by a far more iron tyranny. We shall not always expect to find them supporting our view, but we shall always hope to find them strongly supporting their own freedom, and to remember that in the past, those who foolishly sought power by riding the back of the tiger ended up inside. To those people in the huts and villages of half the globe, struggling to break the bonds of mass misery, we pledge our best efforts to help them help themselves. For whatever period is required, not because the communists may be doing it, not because we seek their votes, but because it is right. If a free society cannot help the many who are poor, it cannot save the few who are rich. To our sister republics south of our border, we offer a special pledge to convert our good words into good deeds, in a new alliance for progress, to assist free men and free governments in casting off the chains of poverty. But this peaceful revolution of hope cannot become the prey of hostile powers. Let all our neighbors know that we shall join with them to oppose aggression or subversion anywhere in the Americas. And let every other power know that this hemisphere intends to remain the master of its own house. To that World Assembly of Sovereign States, the United Nations, our last best hope, in an age where the instruments of war have far outpaced the instruments of peace, we renew our pledge of support to prevent it from becoming merely a forum for invective, to strengthen its shield of the new and the weak, and to enlarge the area in which its writ may run. Finally, to those nations who would make themselves our adversary, we offer not a pledge, but a request that both sides begin anew the quest for peace. Before the dark powers of destruction, unleashed by science, engulf all humanity in planned or accidental self-destruction. We dare not tempt them with weakness, for only when our arms are sufficient beyond doubt can we be certain beyond doubt that they will never be employed. But neither can two great and powerful groups of nations take comfort from our present course, both sides overburdened by the cost of modern weapons, both rightly alarmed by the steady spread of the deadly atom, yet both racing to alter that uncertain balance of terror that stays the hand of mankind's final war. So let us begin anew, remembering on both sides that civility is not a sign of weakness, and sincerity is always subject to proof. Let us never negotiate out of fear, but let us never fear to negotiate. Let both sides explore what problems unite us, instead of belaboring those problems which divide us. Let both sides, for the first time, formulate serious and precise proposals for the inspection and control of arms, and bring the absolute power to destroy other nations under the absolute control of all nations. Let both sides seek to invoke the wonders of science instead of its terrors. Together, let us explore the stars, conquer the desert, eradicate disease, tap the ocean depth, and encourage the arts and commerce. Let both sides unite to heed, in all corners of the earth, the command of Isaiah to undo the heavy burden and let the oppressed go free. And if a beachhead of cooperation may push back the jungle of suspicion, let both sides join in creating a new endeavor, not a new balance of power, but a new world of law, where the strong are just and the weak secure and the peace preserved. All this will not be finished in the first 100 days. Nor will it be finished in the first 1,000 days, nor in the life of this administration, nor even perhaps in our lifetime on this planet. But let us begin. In your hands, my fellow citizens, more than mine, will rest the final success or failure of our cause. Since this country was founded, each generation of Americans has been summoned to give testimony to its national loyalty. The graves of young Americans who answered the call to service surround the globe. Now the trumpet summons us again. Not as a call to bear arms, though arms we need, not as a call to battle, though in battle we are, but a call to bear the burden of a long twilight struggle, year in and year out, rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation, a struggle against the common enemies of man, tyranny, poverty, disease, and war itself. Can we forge against these enemies a grand and global alliance, north and south, east and west, that can assure a more fruitful life for all mankind? Will you join in that historic effort? In the long history of the world, only a few generations have been granted the role of defending freedom in its hour of maximum danger. I do not shrink from this responsibility. I welcome it. I do not believe that any of us would exchange places with any other people or any other generation. The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. My fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of man. Finally, whether you are citizens of America or citizens of the world, ask of us here the same high standards of strength and sacrifice which we ask of you. With a good conscience, our only sure reward, with history the final judge of our deeds, let us go forth to lead the land we love, asking his blessing and his help, but knowing that here on earth, God's work must truly be our own.
That was John F. Kennedy in his inaugural address. Quite an amazing thing, because I would say right now that our country is asking us to stand up for her. Since we're on the air, I'm going to go ahead and not close the show out and just add a couple of other things. Let's skip forward and listen to Martin Luther King and see if we can hear some similarities in the leadership that we are now missing. I'm not saying the Kennedy administration was all that great. After all, we got into Vietnam, an illegal war, if you will, and we've been on since then, but something about Kennedy. Here I'm going to go ahead and play Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. Enjoy. I'll be back in a few.
I have the pleasure to present to you Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation. Five score years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This momentous decree came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of Negro slaves who had been seared in the flames of withering injustice. It came as a joyous daybreak to end the long night of their captivity. But 100 years later, the Negro still is not free. 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination 100 years later. The Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity 100 years later. The Negro has still languished in the corners of American society and finds himself in exile in his own land. And so we've come here today to dramatize a shameful condition. In a sense, we've come to our nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds. But we refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt. We refuse to believe that there are insufficient funds in the great vaults of opportunity of this nation. And so we've come to cash this check, a check that will give us upon demand the riches of freedom and the security of justice. We have also come to this hallowed spot to remind America of the fierce urgency of now. This is no time to engage in the luxury of cooling off or to take the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. Now is the time to make real the promises of democracy. Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley of segregation to the sunlit path of racial justice. Now is the time to lift our nation from the quicksands of racial injustice to the solid rock of brotherhood. Now is the time make justice a reality for all of God's children. It would be fatal for the nation to overlook the urgency of the moment. This sweltering summit of the Negro's legitimate discontent will not pass until that is an invigorating autumn of freedom and equality. 1963 is not an end, but a beginning. Those who hoped that the Negro needed to blow off steam and will now be content will have a rude awakening if the nation returns to business as usual. There will be neither rest nor tranquility in America until the Negro is granted his citizenship rights. The whirlwinds of revolt will continue to shake the foundations of our nation until the bright day of justice emerges. But that is something that I must say to my people who stand on the warm threshold which leads into the palace of justice. In the process of gaining our rightful place, we must not be guilty of wrongful deeds. Let us not seek to satisfy our thirst for freedom by drinking from the cup of bitterness and hatred. We must fail to conduct our struggle on the high plane of dignity and discipline. We must not allow our creative protests to degenerate into physical violence. Again and again, we must rise to the majestic heights of meeting physical force with soul force. The marvelous new militancy which has engulfed the Negro community must not lead us to a distrust of all white people. For many of our white brothers, as evidenced by their presence here today, have come to realize that their destiny is bound to our freedom. We cannot walk alone. As we walk, we must make the pledge that we shall always march ahead. We cannot turn back. There are those who are asking the devotees of civil rights, when will you be satisfied? We can never be satisfied as long as the Negro is the victim of the unspeakable horrors of police brutality. We can never be satisfied. As long as our body is heavy with the fatigue of travel, cannot gain lodging in the motels of the highways and the hotels of the city. We cannot be satisfied as long as a Negro in Mississippi cannot vote and a Negro in New York believes he has nothing for which to vote. No, no, we are not satisfied and we will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. I am not unmindful that some of you have come here out of great trials and tribulations. Some of you have come fresh from narrow jail cells. Some of you have come from areas where your quest for freedom left you battered by the storms of persecution. Yes. And staggered by the winds of police brutality. You have been the veterans of creative suffering. Continue to work with the faith that unearned suffering is redemptive. Go back to Mississippi. Go back to Alabama. Go back to South Carolina. Go back to Georgia. Go back to Louisiana. Go back to the slums and ghettos of our northern cities, knowing that somehow this situation can and will be changed. Let us not wallow in the valley of despair. I say to you today, my friend, so even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. Yes. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. Yes. I have a dream that one day, yes, this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama, with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification. Yes. One day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted. And every hill and mountain shall be made low. The rough places will be made plain. And the crooked places will be made straight. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. This is a faith that I go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. This will be the day when all of God's children will be able to sing with new meaning, "My country, tears of thee. Sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's pride. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. And so let freedom ring. From the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire, let freedom ring. From the mighty mountains of New York, let freedom ring. From the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania, let freedom ring. From the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado, let freedom ring. From the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
One of our other inspirational leaders cut down so soon. For what? It occurs to me that some people have twisted King's words unforgivably. But when you listen to his speech over and over again, you know that that spirit still lives on. The next thing I'm going to do today is to play for you the audio version of the 5,000-year leap, part one. I don't know if any of you have heard it before, but read it before. But this is a book to get a hold of, and it is 48 minutes long. We'll just be doing that through the end of the show, but it will be on the podcast. If you want to download it later, it's a pretty amazing tool. And, you know, our country, 'tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, it still is the best hope for humankind. Here you go, part one, 5,000-year leap.
Part one, the founder's monumental task, structuring a government with all power in the people. The founder's political spectrum. Part of the genius of the founding fathers was their political spectrum, or political frame of reference. It was a yardstick for the measuring of the political power in any particular system of government. They had a much better political yardstick than the one which is generally used today. If the founders had used the modern yardstick of communism on the left and fascism on the right, they never would have found the balanced center which they were seeking. What is left? What is right? It is extremely unfortunate that the writers on political philosophy today have undertaken to measure various issues in terms of political parties instead of political power. No doubt the American founding fathers would have considered this modern measuring stick most objectionable, even meaningless. Today, as we mentioned, it is popular in the classroom as well as the press to refer to communism on the left and fascism on the right. People and parties are often called leftist or rightist. The public do not really understand what they are talking about. These terms actually refer to the manner in which the various parties are seated in the parliaments of Europe. The radical revolutionaries, usually the communists, occupy the far left, and the military dictatorships, such as the fascists, are on the far right. Other parties are located in between. Measuring people and issues in terms of political parties has turned out to be philosophically fallacious, if not totally misleading. This is because the platforms or positions of political parties are often superficial and structured on shifting sand. The platform of a political party of one generation can hardly be recognized by the next. Furthermore, communism and fascism turned out to be different names for approximately the same thing, the police state. They are not opposite extremes, but, for all practical purposes, are virtually identical. The American founding fathers used a more accurate yardstick. Government is defined in the dictionary as a system of ruling or controlling, and therefore the American founders measured political systems in terms of the amount of coercive power or systematic control which a particular system of government exercises over its people. In other words, the yardstick is not political parties, but political power. Using this type of yardstick, the American founders considered the two extremes to be anarchy on the one hand and tyranny on the other. At the one extreme of anarchy, there is no government, no law, no systematic control, and no governmental power, while at the other extreme, there is too much control, too much political oppression, too much government, or as the founders called it, tyranny. The object of the founders was to discover the balanced center between these two extremes. They recognized that under the chaotic confusion of anarchy, there is no law, whereas at the other extreme, the law is totally dominated by the ruling power and is therefore ruler's law. What they wanted to establish was a system of people's law, where the government is kept under the control of the people and political power is maintained at the balanced center, with enough government to maintain security, justice, and good order, but not enough government to abuse the people. The founders' political spectrum might be graphically illustrated as follows. Ruler's Law. The founders seemed anxious that modern man recognize the subversive characteristics of oppressive ruler's law, which they identified primarily with the tyrannical monarchy. Here are its basic characteristics. 1. Authority under ruler's law is nearly always established by force, violence, and conquest. 2. Therefore, all sovereign power is considered to be in the conqueror or his descendants. 3. The people are not equal, but are divided into classes, and are all looked upon as subjects of the king. 4. The entire country is considered to be the property of the ruler. He speaks of it as his realm. 5. The thrust of government power is from the top down, not from the people upward. 6. The people have no inalienable rights. The king giveth, and the king taketh away. 7. Government is by the whims of men, not by the fixed rule of law which the people need in order to govern the affairs with confidence. 8. The ruler issues edicts which are called the law. He then interprets the law and enforces it, thus maintaining tyrannical control over the people. 9. Under ruler's law, problems are always solved by issuing more edicts or laws, setting up more bureaus, harassing the people with more regulators, and charging the people for these services by continually adding to their burden of taxes. 10. Freedom is never looked upon as a viable solution to anything. 11. The long history of ruler's law is one of blood and terror, both anciently and in modern times. Under it, the people are stratified into an aristocracy of the ruler's retinue, while the lot of the common people is one of perpetual poverty, excessive taxation, stringent regulations, and a continuous existence of misery. The founders' attraction to people's law. In direct contrast to the harsh oppression of ruler's law, the founders, particularly Jefferson, admired the institutes of freedom under people's law as originally practiced among the Anglo-Saxons. As one authority on Jefferson points out, quote, Jefferson's great ambition at that time, 1776, was to promote a renaissance of Anglo-Saxon primitive institutions on the new continent. Thus presented, the American Revolution was nothing but the reclamation of the Anglo-Saxon birthright of which the colonists had been deprived by a long trend of abuses. Nor does it appear that there was anything in this theory which surprised or shocked his contemporaries. Adams apparently did not disapprove of it, and it would be easy to bring in many similar expressions of the same idea in documents of the time. End of quote. Characteristics of Anglo-Saxon common law, or people's law. Here are the principal points of people's law as practiced by the Anglo-Saxons. 1. They considered themselves a commonwealth of freemen. 2. All decisions and the selection of leaders had to be with the consent of the people, preferably by full consensus, not just a majority. 3. The laws by which they were governed were considered natural laws given by divine dispensation, and were so well known by the people they did not have to be written down. 4. Power was dispersed among the people and never allowed to concentrate in any one person or group. Even in time of war, the authority granted to the leaders was temporary, and the power of the people to remove them was direct and simple. 5. Primary responsibility for resolving problems rested first of all with the individual, then the family, then the tribe or community, then the region, and finally the nation. 6. They were organized into small, manageable groups where every adult had a voice and a vote. They divided the people into units of 10 families who elected a leader, then 50 families who elected a leader, then 100 families who elected a leader, and then 1,000 families who elected a leader. 7. They believed the rights of the individual were considered unalienable and could not be violated without risking the wrath of divine justice as well as civil retribution by the people's judges. 8. The system of justice was structured on the basis of severe punishment unless there was complete reparation to the person who had been wronged. There were only 4 crimes or offenses against the whole people. These were treason by betraying their own people, cowardice by refusing to fight or failing to fight courageously, desertion, and homosexuality. These were considered capital offenses. All other offenses required reparation to the person who had been wronged. 9. They always attempted to solve problems on the level where the problem originated. If this was impossible, they went no higher than was absolutely necessary to get a remedy. Usually, only the most complex problems involving the welfare of the whole people or a large segment of the people ever went to the leaders for solution. The contrast between ruler's law, all power in the ruler, and people's law, all power in the people, is graphically illustrated below. Note where the power base is located under each of these systems. Also, compare the relationship between the individual and the rest of society under these two systems. The founders note the similarities between Anglo-Saxon common law and the people's law of ancient Israel. As the founders studied the record of the ancient Israelites, they were intrigued by the fact that they also operated under a system of laws remarkably similar to those of the Anglo-Saxons. The two systems were similar both in precept and operational structure. In fact, the Reverend Thomas Hooker wrote the Fundamental Orders of Connecticut based on the principles recorded by Moses in the first chapter of Deuteronomy. These fundamental orders were adopted in 1639 and constituted the first written constitution in modern times. This constitutional charter operated so successfully that it was adopted by Rhode Island. When the English colonies were converted over to independent states, these were the only two states which had constitutional documents which readily adapted themselves to the new order of self-government. All of the other states had to write new constitutions. Here are the principal characteristics of the people's law in ancient Israel, which were almost identical with those of the Anglo-Saxons. 1. They were set up as a commonwealth of freemen. A basic tenet was, "Proclaim liberty throughout all the land, unto all the inhabitants thereof." Leviticus 25:10. This inscription appears on the American Liberty Bell. When the Israelites fell into the temptation to have slaves or bondservants, they were reprimanded. Around 600 B.C., a divine reprimand was given through Jeremiah. "Ye have not hearkened unto me in proclaiming liberty every one to his brother, and every man to his neighbor. Behold, I proclaim a liberty for you, saith the Lord." Jeremiah 34:17. 2. All the people were organized into small, manageable units, where the representative of each family had a voice and a vote. This organizing process was launched after Jethro, the father-in-law of Moses, saw him trying to govern the people under ruler's law. See Exodus 18:13-26. When the structure was completed, the Israelites were organized as follows. Moses, Vice President Aaron, and Vice President Joshua, a Senate or Council of 70. In this way, the founders hoped to memorialize the two ancient peoples who had practiced people's law and from whom the founders had acquired many of their basic ideas for their new commonwealth of freedom. As it turned out, all of this was a little complicated for a small seal, and therefore a more simple design was utilized. However, here is a modern artist's rendition of the original seal as proposed by Jefferson, Adams, and Franklin. Obviously, this is a segment of a